Hello there. Today is Tuesday, February 11th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, today's first Democratic presidential primary election could be the beginning of the end for some candidates.
Are you all ready for a political revolution in New Hampshire?
The World Health Organization becomes increasingly concerned about the coronavirus. Also ahead, a roundup of the glitz, glamour, and big winners at Sunday night's Oscars Awards. It's all on today's International Edition. First in the nation, primary voting begins in just a couple of hours as the Democratic presidential candidates take a look to advance deeper into what could be an extended nominating fight. President Trump is in New Hampshire at a rally and earlier joked that GOP voters could sabotage Tuesday's Democratic presidential primary.
We hear that there could be, because you have crossovers in primaries, don't you? So I hear a lot of Republicans tomorrow will vote for the weakest candidate possible of the Democrats. Does that make sense? You people wouldn't do that. My only problem is I'm trying to figure out who is their weakest candidate. I think they're all weak.
Bernie Sanders showed the same confidence he displayed ahead of last week's Iowa caucuses, which ended with a split decision between the Vermont senator and former mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, Indiana. At a campaign event in Manchester, New Hampshire, Sanders pointed to his grassroots campaign being all about taking on powerful special interests.
It's about bringing our people together to begin the process to end the presidency of Donald Trump, and to transform our country so that we have an economy and a government that work for all of us, not just wealthy campaign contributors.
Democratic presidential candidate Senator Amy Klobuchar, who has been rising in the polls, joked to supporters in New Hampshire about the troubles with the vote count in Iowa.
I am someone that can win this thing. And I think that's why we are surging. I think the people of New Hampshire get it. You are a state that's a primary, so people can vote who are independent as well as our fired up Democratic base. You know how to count votes. I have been through kind of a traumatic experience. How to get this done.
Former Vice President Joe Biden, once the national frontrunner, tamped down expectations amid prospects of a second consecutive disappointment before the race turns to more racially diverse states that he believes he can win. And joining us now from New Hampshire is VOA correspondent Carolyn Pursuti. Carolyn, thanks for being with us. You've been on the ground there. What are you seeing as far as voter energy and expected turnout in New Hampshire?
So far, I'm very impressed with all the residents of New Hampshire. You know, they truly take it as a source of pride in how they are the first in the nation primary. But even beyond that, it's the homework that they do. They do so much research on these candidates so that when they show up at one of their events, they know everything about them, but they want to hear them. Hmm. And that's what the real key is in New Hampshire. It matters if they've seen the candidate, if they shake their hand, and if they get that one-on-one time. And luckily, New Hampshire's a small enough state that the candidates can do that. They can go all over the state. They can traverse it and meet with as many people as possible.
It's interesting because just since Iowa, the debacle with the caucus there, the polls have been changing dramatically. Are you seeing people that still feel undecided going into this vote?
Absolutely. In fact, 43% of the electorate is an independent, which means they could vote Republican, they could vote Democrat, and they really don't make up their mind until the very last minute. I talked to numerous people that said, oh, it might be Tuesday morning, or maybe I'll make my decision in the voting booth. I'm shocked because that's not the norm across the United States, but here in New Hampshire, it seems to be. One woman I talked to was doing a spreadsheet, and she just finished it last night. She was ranking every candidate on their issues and how they meshed with her issues that she's passionate about, and came up with a name. She told me what it was, but she worked on that spreadsheet for days.
Interesting, because we've been hearing a lot about how Democrats are mostly concerned about electability and beating Donald Trump and less about issues, but it sounds like the people there are really concerned as well about the issues they care about.
But don't get me wrong, you do have that subset of people that just want to vote for the person that comes out in the polls as the one who can beat Donald Trump. You do have people that I would interview and I would say, who are you voting for? And then I'd say, is that because of the issues or because you want a new person in the White House? And they would come back to me and say, oh no, I want this person to beat Donald Trump. So that is one of the factors that they look at when they're choosing a candidate.
Are you hearing one name in particular or some people in particular? Are certain names coming up more than others from people?
I'll actually tell you who I'm hearing about the most, and that's Pete Buttigieg. I hear a lot of people telling me that's my choice. Certainly Bernie Sanders. Now, the interesting thing about Bernie Sanders is, too, that I covered an event the other day where it was a huge dinner and all of the candidates were present. There were about 7,000 people in this huge arena, and they each got to cheer individually for the candidates. So that when an individual candidate walked out, you would hear a roar from the crowd. The largest cheers were for Bernie Sanders. The loudest and the longest cheers were for Bernie Sanders, followed by Elizabeth Warren. Now, that's not a surprise, though, because Elizabeth Warren, of course, is the senator from Massachusetts, and that's right next door to us here in New Hampshire. So I think a lot of the residents here are very familiar with her and her policy.
Well, they say New Hampshire's the state that picks presidents. I guess people feel a pretty strong responsibility there, as you said.
That's true. I talked to a historian and a political analyst, and he said to me, we always picked the president until it came to Bill Clinton, and that's the first year we didn't. However, they did go for Trump last year in the primary, and of course he became president. And the year before that, for Obama, came in second here. So, yes, you get a pretty good gauge of who is going to do well with every primary, every caucus from here on out.
And Carolyn, I understand even after the polls are closed and all the votes are cast, they won't be announcing the results today. Why is that? What's going on?
Well, you're right, and it is rather surprising, but I spoke with someone in the Secretary of State's office who handles the elections, and she said, we're going to wait to tabulate all the votes from the individual precincts. Now, the individual precincts will each announce who won in their precinct. Well, there are 309 polling places, so that's 309 votes. I guess we could poll them all. I guess we could canvass them all, go out in person and ask them who won and then add it up. But the Secretary of State's office says they will not make the official announcement until 5 a.m. on Wednesday. So Wednesday morning, we will know who won New Hampshire, but not any sooner than that.
All right, VOA correspondent Carolyn Pursuti, thanks. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer is asking the Defense Department watchdog to investigate President Trump's impeachment retaliation. Turkish soldiers have been killed in Syria as tensions with Damascus escalate. President Trump and the First Lady plan to travel to India at the end of the month. And from dust to diamonds, a startup company is transforming cremated ashes into sparkling jewels. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Donald Trump is proposing a steep 21% cut in aid to the United States, which that it provides to foreign countries, and the State Department stands by the draft budget. But U.S. lawmakers who control the budget process say the proposed cuts in foreign assistance would weaken U.S. national security and global leadership. VOA diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports from Washington.
U.S. foreign aid to developing countries and to international relief organizations is the target of drastic cuts in the Trump administration's budget for the third year in a row. Each year, Congress rejected the cuts to foreign aid and approved more money than asked for, prompting this exchange at the State Department Monday.
For the last 3 years, these proposals have been made. Now, while this is 21% cut and not 34 or 35% as in previous years, it's been laughed off the hill.
We absolutely stand by this budget. We think it prioritizes the most important needs identified by the great men and women of the State Department, USAID. This is a bottom-up process of how we come up with the priorities.
Some members of Congress were quick to denounce the cuts, including House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Elliot Engel, who called the cuts reckless and said they would weaken U.S. leadership in the world if ever enacted. Some foreign policy experts say President Donald Trump should realize that foreign aid is an effective tool to address pressing problems.
If we're not doing that, other places are going to see more violence and poor governance and the sorts of problems that he tries to address by building a wall on the southern border, migrants and refugees. These are the sorts of things that are addressed by foreign aid.
The State Department says the budget request maintains the United States as the single largest donor in humanitarian assistance and global health, while also asking other countries and partners to do more. Cindy Sain, VOA News, Washington.
The head of the World Health Organization says there are concerning instances of coronavirus transmission from people who are not or have not traveled to China. It's a development that could mean there is a bigger problem. This comes as a World Health Organization team of medical experts arrived in China Monday, and the toll surpassed that of the SARS epidemic in 2002 and 2003. According to WHO's latest data, there are now over 40,000 confirmed cases in China and nearly 915 deaths. Outside of China, there are hundreds more cases and at least one death. Mariana Diablo brings us the latest.
The coronavirus brought a grim start to the new week. Chinese Health Commission Sunday reported 97 deaths from the coronavirus, the largest number in a single day. And it has now killed more people than the SARS epidemic about 18 years ago. Dr. Sylvie Briand of the World Health Organization.
How many people are have mild disease? It's around 80%. How many people are of a severe disease, mostly a pneumonia that requires hospitalization? From the latest data, it's around 15%. And also, it's around also 3 to 4% of people who will need, 3 to 5% of people will need intensive care. So what will make a difference in terms of mortality is really the underlying condition of the patient.
And there are new concerns about the virus transmission in France and Britain from people with no travel history to China.
The detection of this small number of cases could be the spark that becomes a bigger fire. But for now, it's only a spark. Our objective remains containment.
Meanwhile, nearly a week into quarantine on the Diamond Princess off the coast of Japan, about 140 cases of coronavirus have been confirmed on the ship. Among those infected, 23 Americans, including Rebecca Fraser.
You never think that something like this is going to happen when you're just on vacation, living life.
In the same ship, an Australian family passes the time.
I know some other families who because they've got separate rooms with kids, are unable to see their kids. And we're all together, we can see each other, we know we're all safe. So.
They have been confined to their cabin on the quarantine ship for a week.
We've been doing a bit of stretching and exercise in the room just to make sure that, we're keeping a bit healthy. We've got reading, we've got movies to watch. The kids are doing a lot of social media stuff with friends, chatting with friends.
Meanwhile, in China's Hubei province, the center of the outbreak, millions remain under lockdown and people are complaining of food shortages. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Well, New York State is suing the Trump administration for blocking state residents from taking part in programs that allow travelers to avoid long lines at borders and airports. AP correspondent Tim McGuire reports.
New York Attorney General Letitia James is suing the Department of Homeland Security, claiming it's punishing the state by dropping residents from the Preferred Travelers Program in response to the green light law allowing people to get state driver's licenses without legal residency. Acting Department of Homeland Security Secretary Ken Cuccinelli says the law endangers the public and federal agents who can't quickly confirm someone's identity, check for warrants, or see if a person has a criminal record. James says that information is available from other sources, and she accuses President Trump of trying to coerce the state government to change its policies to comply with his federal policies. I'm Tim McGuire.
Four members of the Chinese military have been charged with breaking into the computer networks of the Equifax credit reporting agency and stealing the personal information of tens of millions of Americans. At a news conference, Attorney General Bill Barr blamed Beijing for one of the largest hacks in history targeting consumer data.
The hackers obtained the names, birth dates, and social security numbers of nearly 150 million Americans and the driver's licenses of at least 10 million Americans.
Barr said the scale of the theft was staggering and not only caused significant financial damage to Equifax, but invaded the privacy of many millions of Americans and imposed substantial costs and burdens on them as they've had to take measures to protect against identity theft. Also at the news conference, FBI Director or Deputy Director David Bowditch said some might wonder what good it does to indict hackers that are beyond the reach of the U.S. government.
We can't take them into custody, try them in a court of law, and lock them up. Not today, anyway. But one day, these criminals will slip up, and when they do, we'll be there.
Well, the case is the latest U.S. accusation against Chinese hackers suspected of breaching networks of American corporations, including steel manufacturers, a hotel chain, and a health insurer. It comes as the Trump administration has warned against what it sees as the growing political and economic influence of China and efforts by Beijing to collect data for financial and intelligence purposes and to steal research and innovation. You're listening to International Edition. We'll be back in a minute.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
This is Science in a Minute.
Many consider the smartphone a technological wonder. With it, you can communicate with family and friends, as well as listen to music, check the weather or latest news, and with built-in GPS, keep yourself from getting lost. What many would consider a good smartphone feature is a way for it to help keep yourself healthy. While most smartphone manufacturers are concerned with regulatory issues a feature like this would bring, scientists at the University of Cincinnati have developed a small phone add-on medical system that would be able to monitor and detect a number of health conditions. The scientists say that with just a single drop of blood or saliva on a custom lab chip, the device can diagnose infectious diseases or countless other health conditions. After gathering diagnostic data, the device then automatically transmits the information to a doctor. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. The movie industry's biggest night at the Academy Awards on Sunday had moments of laughter, sentiment, and surprises.
And the Oscar goes to Parasite. We never imagined this to ever happen. We are so happy.
Joaquin Phoenix, Joker.
I've been a scoundrel in my life. I've been selfish.
have been cruel at times, hard to work with, and ungrateful, but so many of you in this room have given me a second chance. And I think that's when we're at our best, when we support each other, not when we cancel each other out for past mistakes, but when we help each other to grow, when we educate each other, when we guide each other towards redemption. That is the best of humanity.
The Oscar goes to Renee Zellweger.
When we celebrate our heroes, we, you know, we're reminded of who we are as one people, united.
And the Oscar goes to Taika Waititi, Jojo Rabbit.
This is really great, and I dedicate this to all the Indigenous kids in the world who want to do art and dance and write stories. We are the original storytellers, and we can make it here as well. Thank you. Kia ora.
Brad Pitt.
They told me I only have 45 seconds up here, which is 45 seconds more than the Senate gave John Bolton this week. I'm thinking maybe Quentin does a movie about it, and in the end, the adults do the right thing. I'm a bit gobsmacked. I'm not one to look back, but this has made me do so, and I think of my folks taking me to the drive-in to see Butch and Sundance, and loading up my car and moving out here, and Gina and Ridley giving me my first shot, to all the wonderful people I've met along the way, to stand here now. Once upon a time in Hollywood, ain't that the truth?
Social class satire Parasite made history in both the Hollywood and South Korean film industries. The class satire is the first non-English language film to win Best Picture in the 92-year history of the Academy Awards and is the first South Korean movie to ever win an Oscar. The film won three other awards as well. Before director Bong Joon-ho's Parasite made history as the first non-English Best Picture winner in history, he made a modest plea to American moviegoers. Don't be afraid of subtitles. Joining us now to talk about the show, in general, the Oscars, and of course this historic win, Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Jeff, your reaction to all of it, especially this historic win by Parasite?
Well, you know, Parasite was the little movie that could. I remember seeing it 6 months ago and just being blown away by it. You know, director Bong Joon-ho is one of my favorite directors, so he was the director to watch, you know. And I love how the Academy and his film is international cinema, because cinema is international art form, you know, not just American films. I've turned so many people on to French films, Japanese films, even Indian films. It's a worldwide art form. So I'm so glad that finally it's now making it into the Academy, other than just the best foreign feature, which was now changed to best international feature. So it's amazing how he took home Best Director, Best Original Screenplay. I mean, this was the little movie that could. And when he took home Best Director, I'm like, wow, he had a chance to win Best Picture. Because usually 90% of the time, those movies go hand in hand. And the way to figure out exactly how movies you can, for the Academy, you kind of judge what's going to win, is that it's all voted by industry insiders. Meaning that all the directors vote for director, all the actors vote for actor, everybody votes for Best Picture. So if the Directors Guild gives it to a 1917, pretty much that's what the Academy members, because they're both members of both unions. But this is the year that didn't happen, and I think it's fantastic that the Academy did that. And there was a lot of complaints about women not being nominated, which I absolutely agree with, and then we had Oscars So White a few years ago. That was the most diverse show that I've seen the Oscars do in years, you know, from the opening numbers to the presenters. So what they lacked in nominations for women, they sure made up by including such a multiracial cast and cultural cast throughout the evening.
What did you think about Best Actor and Actress Joaquin Phoenix as well as Renee Zellweger? Both very interesting movies. The speech in of itself with Joaquin Phoenix was memorable. Did you think they got it right this year?
Well, I was cringing during those speeches because they just rambled on. The show was already 3 hours and going into overtime by that time. And he never mentioned Joker once. He never said anything about the movie. He never thanked Todd Phillips, the director, or anybody involved with the film. He just got up there, which seemed like 15-minute rant about the environment. So I just thought that was really out of place for him to do that. But he's a little unhinged, and, you know, most eccentric geniuses are. So, and then when Renee Zellweger won for Judy, which was totally, really agreed with both of those, they're both great performances, but she did the same thing. She just went on and on and on, and the Academy was afraid to cut them off.
The ratings were down pretty significantly people were saying they thought it was a boring show. Sounds like you did not, you don't agree with that.
Well, it depends. I think they really could cut the show out by an hour and a half, cut it in half. As much as I love and I appreciate all the industry people, all the technical people, you had like best production design, best sound mixing, best film editing, best costume design. They need to do like they did with the Herschat Humanitarian Award and the Honorary Oscars. They just mentioned them and have them in the audience. They were there saying, we had a separate ceremony for them this year. We honored them. Everybody's applause. That's what they need to do with the technical awards, too. People are not sitting around waiting for best sound mixing, and they need to streamline it. They need to kind of get some new energy in there and some new young blood for the next generation. I saw that. It went from like 22 million last year to like 11 million, especially after 2 hours. It dropped off significantly. So the Academy needs to get modern. They need to get hip, and they need to retire publicly some of those awards to give out, because as important as they are to filmmaking and to Hollywood, you know, viewers don't stick around to see who won Best Sound Mixing.
I will say they at least recruited one of the hottest singers around for a younger generation in Billie Eilish for the memorial.
She did great. I thought she was fantastic too. And also the best songs, man, they just went on and on and on. Cynthia and Revo did Stand Up, I thought was fantastic. Elton John brought down the house.
Oh, so yeah.
This year, the musical performances were some of the best moments.
All right, Jeffrey K. Howard, find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. As Jeff just mentioned, there were some great musical performances at Sunday night's Oscars. One of the hottest new artists, 18-year-old Billie Eilish, gave a moving rendition of the iconic Beatles song yesterday as the screen scrolled through all of the industry people who passed away over the past year. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Tony Pollock. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day. Such an easy game to play. Now I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa.
VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is VOA.